Welcome to the Down and Dirty Podcast, the ultimate guide to modern midlife dating. I'm your host, Celeste Moore, and I'm here to help you navigate the challenges of today's dating world. Think of me as your female version of Hitch, but better. With over 16 years of experience as a certified image consultant and dating coach, I've got the inside scoop on what women want. In this podcast, we're diving deep into the world of healthy masculinity and modern dating. It's a fast-changing industry, and here you'll find personal stories, expert insights, and candid conversations that will empower you to take control of your dating life. There's never been a better time to achieve your desired outcome, whether it's marriage, finding a significant other, securing a life partner, or simply regaining your dating confidence. We're here with you twice a week to explore the viewpoints and challenges in today's dating arena that resonate with every man seeking dating success and love. So let's dive into today's episode. We've got an exciting discussion lined up for you. Get ready for the double D's of dating, where dating dilemmas turn into dating triumphs. I want to welcome everybody to another episode of the Down and Dirty Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Celeste Moore. Excuse me for my little rough voice today. I'm not a smoker. just a little sore throat, but I appreciate everybody who continues to show up here and listen to these shows. I put this out to educate people, to hopefully bring little nuggets out into their relationship and that they can grow and evolve. And if you feel so inclined to, please leave a review for the show. 5 stars would be amazing. It really just brings it to the forefront and helps everybody in return. So I'm super, super excited to talk to my guest today. But before we dive into the episode, I would love to introduce him. His name is Dr. Brendan Kwiatkowski, and he is a researcher and educator focused on the social, emotional development and well-being of boys and men, and how that intersects with the well-being of others. His PhD research investigated teenage boys' experiences and beliefs about being male and compared their experiences based on their levels of emotional expression. He is super passionate about focus, positive focus, and person-centered research that humanizes and empowers participants, as well as in research that is transformative and practically useful for people in real world. He lives in Vancouver, BC, where he teaches at a local university and loves breathwork, cold plunges, and lots of other things. Cold plunges. Wow. I love that about you because I wish I felt the same way. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me, Celeste. It's great to be here.
Yes. So there's so much to talk about. You have so many different facets of your research and your experience with, you know, not only teenage boys, but men. And I would love to hear a little bit more about your backstory and how your journey kind of went down this road of achieving, let's say, your doctorate.
Yeah. So I was a high school teacher in Vancouver, BC, and I wanted to do my master's in special education. And while I was doing that, I found the statistic that around 81% of all students diagnosed with emotional and behavioral disorders are male. And so that led me on an academic journey towards how much of this is biology, how much of this is sociology. And I was a biology teacher and a history teacher prior to that. So I was really curious about that question. And long story short is that regardless of the importance of biology, is that the social factors around masculinity do play a huge role in sort of how boys and men show up in the world. And I became really interested in that. I developed programs for male teenagers with behavioral need. And then, long story short, I realized there was so much complexity in this topic that sometimes is missed in common conversations around masculinity. And so my PhD research really wanted to prize apart the complexity, specifically around emotional expression. So yeah, I compared the least emotionally expressive to the most emotionally expressive teenage boys who are age 17 to 19. But there's also a thing in social sciences that all research is me-search. And so that's my academic way of starting. But I don't think I realized when I set out
of how much introspection to my own kind of gendered upbringing there was. I often say, like, the first memory I have of gender being like a thing, I grew up in evangelical church, and I remember asking my parents about, like, oh, why is the woman's pastor always called a coordinator if the other pastors are always called pastors? And that with the church I was at growing up was like, didn't believe that women could be in the pastor role. So I remember I just kind of always stuck out to me as something looking back on, and just like, yeah, my own relationship with masculinity is a huge, I'll be lying if it wasn't kind of a part of my own research. And of course, I've also been impacted by the suicides of people in my life. And we know statistics of men greater disproportionate rate of dying from suicide. And so, yeah, all these factors together, like I care about this topic for multiple reasons.
Yeah, I really love that. And I'm so sorry for your personal experience with suicide. And I was actually going to bring that up later in the show, but I'd love to kind of dive into just that little piece right there. I've had a few, you know, topics about, you know, men and their roles in society and their and emotions and how we view a man being showing up with his, you know, emotions and if it's okay and all of this stuff. But I mean, no, that's a lot, but I know that the suicide rates are extremely high in men. And from what I understand, is the reasoning for this is because they don't know how to properly express their feelings and emotions. And if they do, they could be shamed. I mean, I'm sure there's so much more to it, but I know that that's such a huge problem in our society.
And, yeah, that's 100% a huge factor to that. But if I could speak more to it, I think sometimes that gets overemphasized because there's a thing, especially around middle-aged men, there's a significant body of research in the UK that like 91% of middle-aged men who died from suicide sought help within the month prior to their suicide. So it's not just that they won't seek help at all, although the masculine belief that you shouldn't show your emotion and that you shouldn't seek help from others, those are two major factors in why suicide rates can be higher. But the main thing that also factors in is masculinity too, but the main thing, or one of the main factors with suicide rates, is the feelings of hopelessness. And so it's when like circumstances, it's kind of like when this whole terrible mix of things of like, yeah, maybe you're less likely to share your emotions because you might get shamed for it. You don't want to be a burden to people. Maybe it's also because you're not used to seeking help from other people. And so you're not as familiar in knowing how to do that. But it's kind of like when that combines with like losing your job or a relationship ending where you just don't see hope, a light at the end of the tunnel, then that kind of exacerbates the situation, which increases your odds of dying from suicide.
And do you think as a society, we put more pressure on men to have it together, know what to do, be the provider? Do you feel that that's not as prevalent as it was, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago?
It's always hard to answer the question of more. Do we have more pressure now than later or more compared to women? I think that there is different pressure. Like, I think there's tons of pressure for women of doing everything and looking effortlessly doing it. And I think that there's still a huge amount of pressure on men that sometimes on men putting them on themselves, society also puts on men of to be wearing the pants in the relationship, quote unquote, or yeah, being the breadwinner provider. And it's a changing world because the amount of women or female partners in relationships that bring in equal or more income than their male partners are hugely significant. And so like things are changing, and obviously there's always going to be reactions to whether that change is good or bad. But yeah, but you can also look at statistics of women, yeah, they're working more, but they're also still doing more of the household work at the house. And so there's lots of tension and complexity in answering that question, but there is still tons of pressure on men to
have their shit together. By that, I mean like to have their financial stuff in order or their emotions in check, because there's a sense, however accurate or not, that if I am too emotional, aka weak, then no woman is going to love me, or they don't actually want that, even if the social media is like trying to go towards positive masculinity, which is more emotionally expressive. One of the most common comments I see online on social media is like, oh no, you can't actually trust a woman with that. They'll just use that against you. So there's so much polarization, as I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah. And I thank you for touching on that. I've had quite a few, not just clients, but men feel very comfortable speaking to me. I hope I allow a space that's really non-judgmental and I just listen. And I've had multiple men come to me with a traumatic experience that they've had in their life. And a few have said, I've said that to one other person and I got basically shamed for it, or something where like, you shouldn't say that, or whatever it was, this person really needed to express, they needed to let out some trauma that had happened to them. And after that experience, he chose not to ever bring that up again and live with that inside. And that to me is just like heart-wrenching. And I really hope that you, working with younger generation and teenagers, and that this, you know, starts to close that gap a little bit.
That reminds me of a theme I identified in my research of these teenage boys, that the boys that were the most emotionally expressive, I called it women as emotional safe haven. So these emotional safe havens that the boys that were more emotionally expressive tended to prefer to talk about their more vulnerable emotions, such as sadness or fear, with the women in their lives, whether that was their peers or their mothers. And so I think there's a lot of tensions here. So I'm going to address them. One is that women, like in what the research indicates, are often a huge source of emotional connection for men. And then if you listen to women, a lot of them like being that to a point, but they wish it was reciprocated more, that it wasn't like, sometimes some women feel like, yeah, totally, I love showing up that way. And then some focus on like, it feels one-sided. I've been in so many relationships where I've been kind of teaching them more about their emotions, being a sounding board for them and their emotional expression, and it hasn't been reciprocated as much. And so then we talk like women do more of the emotional labor in a relationship, or emotional work in a relationship. And then there's another dynamic that I have a theory about, is that a lot of these boys in my research, they said like, oh yeah, they'll view their male relationship different than their female relationship. So they'll view like the boys in their lives as like, okay, I'm going to have fun with them, I'm going to hang out with them and vent about things I'm angry about, but I'm not going to share my full vulnerability, but I'll save that for the women in my life. And so sometimes when I hear, I want to preface this, I don't want to devalue or minimize any man's experience who has had their emotions weaponized against them. I'm not questioning that happened whatsoever. I'm curious as how many of those men have, maybe those women in their lives were some of the most vulnerable relationships they've ever been in before. So like, if you haven't been as vulnerable or authentic with all your emotional experiences, like with your male friend, then it's almost giving like, you're putting all your eggs in one basket of like, if you do it with just one woman, rather than if you kind of had multiple friends to do that with. I wonder if that exacerbates. That's kind of my theory, is that like, yeah, that's why it can be so painful and why you might shut down, because you were so hurt by that relationship, by that woman in that relationship. But I have this question in my mind of, I wonder if that's because, yeah, you gave your vulnerable self to that one person and you haven't had that much, as much experience kind of having more of that. So you're kind of more able to like have some practice in emotionally vulnerable relationships.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. It's good to know a little bit more about that situation. I really want to talk about, I love that you brought up the, you know, the teenagers excuse me, you said when the ones that are 17 to 19, what did you found that they were, sorry, they were more emotional, or that wasn't due to age? That was.
Oh, I had 170 of them in my research, and I gave them a screening tool with a couple of things to determine how willing they were to talk about their feelings with other people in their lives. So then I ranked them based on their willingness to express their emotions honestly with people in their lives. And so then I compared the least emotionally expressive to the most emotionally expressive and how different their beliefs and experiences were.
Okay, perfect. And what did you find with the boys that were more emotionally expressive? Yeah.
Well, yeah, the first thing to say is that there's a lot more in common than not between all of the boys. Like, their experiences of being teenage boys were very across the board common. And where I get the divergent point happens around as well. Obviously, when we talk about sociology, there's always going to be exceptions to the trend. But generally speaking, the transition from elementary school to high school, is a pivotal time period. Start of puberty, so like age 13, 14, 15, all of the boys, regardless of their level of emotional expression by grade 12 level, they all said that was the hardest time period of their lives, where the masculine pressures were at their highest. So the masculine pressure to like fit in, but how do you fit in? It's by restricting your emotions, particularly fear and sadness, and like physically and mentally tough. So athleticism can fit into that, but just like being like working out more, being physically imposing or tough and not letting things bother you or making it seem like nothing bothers you and not being intimidated by anything. So like those pressures were at the zenith at that age. And then where we do a separation is I've identified in my research three different categories of responses to those pressures. So you had the willingly adhering boy. So they, when faced with those pressures, they're like, okay, this is how I become a man. And maybe I see my father has done the same. I don't see anything wrong with how my father has done things. So like, okay, this is how I become a man, is by following these pressures and doing these things. So I call that willingly adhering. And then I called reluctant adherence, which I would say was the main group. And reluctant adherence, they saw the flaws in adhering to these pressures. For instance, a lot of them were like, oh, I wish I had more emotional connection with my male friend. I don't think any of my male friends want that. They kind of feel like they're alone in it. And they feel like they reluctantly are adhering because they think the benefits of adhering outweigh the cost. So the benefit being you feel socially included in your peer group. Because the desire to fit in with your peer from that developmentally from that stage is so high. And so they're like, yeah, I kind of critique a bit pressures, but at the same time, I feel trapped in here. I don't know how to get out of there. And then the last category, which all the boys who were highly emotionally expressive by grade 12, I would categorize in here, I call it internal and external resistance to these masculine pressures. And essentially, in order to resist these masculine pressures, they all just felt internally that something felt wrong to shut off parts of themselves, that like a desire at some point, like around age 15, as they were leaving that kind of early high school age, they just felt like, oh, I don't like how I'm becoming more fake or inauthentic. Like, I just don't like it. And then of course it helps when you have some friends that also are in the same boat, or like, oh yeah, I changed up my friend group. Or like people accepted me kind of for who I was. And so the key thing here with these boys and being able to kind of step out, kind of reclaim parts of themselves that they had to put on the back burner, especially at school, is having confidence to do so. And that confidence piece was really interesting, is that the boys that had the most confidence to reclaim their emotional parts of themselves also tended to be athletic. And so we can look at like kind of social currency, that it's easier for boys and men who are respected for certain masculine qualities, like being an athlete
is that you kind of have more cachet that if you are also in touch with your emotions, then you can kind of more readily break out of the man box, so to speak, without as much peer judgment. Kind of like the cooler you are, the more you can kind of like have your own niche thing. Like if you're a cool person who likes Pokemon in high school, you might be okay with it. If you're a non-popular student who likes Pokemon in high school, you might get made fun of it.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't look any different than when I was in high school. So it's interesting, though. So just like middle-aged men, right? A lot of my listeners here are that age range, and they're just jumping into the dating world. And how do you feel that this is much different being at, like, let's say 40, you know, than... I know that there is so many changes when you're a teenager, and I'm not trying to take that away from the experience. I guess it's still very similar in the sense that, you know, if they have confidence, they can be a little bit different. I'm not taking away from the experiences of how hard it is to be a teenager, right? That's
the
full effects of growth and emotions and trying to fit in is... Nobody wants to go back to that time in their life. I know I don't. And especially for boys, it's such a struggle and it's such a pressure to fit in. But I go back to my audience here, who's mostly middle-aged, and, you know, they've been in a relationship for a while, and now they're not, and now they're looking to date again. And I find this with a lot of my clients is, you said something that was really profound. It's like, the guy that's confident, he can step out and be different. He can be his authentic self without as much judgment. And I know that even with my clients, I'm bringing them on, and, you know, confidence is key, you know, but I really, really push being your authentic self. I know it's harder at 15 than it is at 40, but some guys haven't grown since then emotionally. Some men are stuck in that age. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say that it could be harder at 42. It kind of depends on the trajectory of your life, of where you've been. Like, so for instance, one of the most profound things I personally learned from these teenage boys is that the most emotionally restricted teenage boys all knew when and why they started to restrict their emotions. So they all, I thought some of them would just be like, oh, I've always been this way, this is just who I am. But they all remembered what was going on and why they start to restrict their emotions. And I've talked to lots of older men about this, and most of them can remember, but a lot of them have forgot. And so I think that the longer you've been disconnected from parts of yourself, getting reconnected with them can be really hard. And so when we talk about, like, yeah, teenage boys, what does this have to do with middle-aged men? Is that there is actually a lot of research that has done longitudinal research on teenage boys and their beliefs around masculinity and how that correlates to different health benefits or risks later on in life. And so the linkage between your masculinity in high school to later on in life is actually quite linked. I think the same dynamics of, like, we kind of talked a bit before the show about, like, what are men hearing about masculinity these days? And, like, as the world is changing, like, it's easier or simpler to be one of those boys or to be a man who's willingly adhering to, like, a set of instructions about, this is what a man is, so I'm going to go for this, and who cares what's in the way, this is just what I'm doing. That is way more, there's way less internal turmoil than to be in the reluctant adherence, feeling like, oh, I feel like I should be this way. I'm not sure where my own authenticity intersects with this. I feel like people want me to be this way. I feel like I'm trying to be a certain way, and I just don't know where I'm landing. And then you're not landing in, like, a confidence zone, which does make going back into the dating world way harder. And so it's kind of like we talk about, like, doing inner work, or how do we find out what our authentic self is? And it's like, how does our masculine beliefs tie in with that? Like, I think these are very much parallel to middle age. Like, I think that a lot of men who are anti-feminism, let's say, they like the simplicity of what the gender roles were on paper, at least, before feminism came about and kind of changed how the working force works and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of self-reflection that men have to do.
Yeah. And I love that you correlated the two, because they obviously, it starts sometime in our life. Our belief systems doesn't just, you know, oh, it's an age, we're going through something. It progresses. It starts when we're really young. And like you said, it usually we emulate our parents. And whether it's good or bad, it's just kind of how we were raised and experienced life. Doesn't mean they have to stay the same. And I think that if you do start having that self-reflection and start really getting internalizing with your beliefs and do I really believe that, or is that just what my parents projected on me? And start asking these questions. I think that's going to definitely help with, you know, life in general, but dating is very specific. So there is this, I wanted to ask you and talk to you about, because I feel that a lot of people in my age gap, like late 30s to like even up to like early 60s, people don't know, especially men, their roles. And I know that it's such like nobody should have a particular role. Like I think there's so much diversity in how you can show up. But, you know, I have the women that are single and successful and they're like, why can't I just find a man? You know, why can't I just find a guy that's like, open the door for me, do this, like chase me a little bit. Why is it that I've got to chase them or call them, like, you know, this dichotomy of like what's weak and what's strong? How can we move forward in this modern age, right, of society and our roles? How can we start to, I don't know, heal it, fix it? I don't know if that's even a thing, but work on it.
I hope it is, because I'm working on a book right now that's really about that topic.
And amazing.
I think that some of the things that one really important thing to hold is how we move forward is that we have to kind of find this balance between a widespread sociological scale of like what is the role from like in a culture perspective versus what is my personal embodiment role. And because I think a huge error happens when it's like, oh, here's something that works really well for you. And maybe even works really well with you and your partner, but like having more traditional roles, but recognizing that at a collective level, at a societal level, like I don't see us going backwards in time of getting kind of more, yeah, more restricted in that sense. So there's so many things. One is that I think what's so hard about the changes that have happened for let's say like 30 to 60 year olds is that like a huge factor of how boys and men have been brought up with masculinity is from our fathers. Not everything, but that huge factor is our fathers. And it's not even what they implicitly said to us, but so much more is picked up. Or sorry, I think I said the wrong word. It's not so much they explicitly said things, but it's how they just were in the world. And we take that in and we use that. And so, and I feel like I just went a bit over the place.
It's okay. That was a very open-ended question. I'm like, how do we fix this?
Yeah, I know. And for here, I have so much, what's going on in my brain right now is like, oh, I have so many different brains. I was like, different brains going on, different pictures going on of how to tackle that question. But what's the one I should hone in on? There's a concept of like, that I really like, that a Franciscan father called Dr. Richard Rohr talks about, that in societies, there's movements from order, disorder to reorder. And so if you look at traditional gender roles as being order, we're kind of in this, and then things have been a bit more disorder, but now we're trying to figure out what does reorder look like in this kind of new age where women are working more with, like roles are changing. So like, yeah, how do we fit that in? And so you're going to have people that want to go back to the order. And what I heard you say in your question of like women being like, I want a man who knows himself essentially and can like confidently like kind of that chivalry, there was a kind of a tone of that in. And then you'll hear some like anti-feminist men rights activist men being like, oh, that's the double standard, because it's like, you didn't want that. Like, you got rid of that order, and because feminism did all this, blah, blah, blah. And they blame feminism for a lot of this. And I think it's just a fundamental, I don't know if it's a misunderstanding intentionally or not, but the fundamental error of how we're looking at the thing is that if you're looking at the man you want to be as like, here are the rules to follow, and like, I need to do this or not do this, you're not going to be authentically in your body, self-led. It's not going to be so attractive to a partner. If you're doing something for the sake of doing it, like, that's where we get this idea of the good guy or the nice guy who like does the right things on paper, but then get like, it feels a sense of entitlement, or like, I did the right thing, so why don't you like me type thing. And you can kind of, that's a slippery slope, I would argue, like to almost like the incel culture of feeling like super entitled to women sexually in that sense. Mm-hmm. And so a huge mind shift or paradigm shift is like, women want men who know themselves. And how do we get to know ourselves? Is we have to spend time with ourselves. So if we have little boys that were cut up from their emotions for various reasons, the top three reasons in my research were fear of judgment from others, fear of being a burden to others, and fear of experiencing trauma again, meaning those boys had been emotionally close to someone in their lives, but whether through death or just like some of their times it was their best friend suddenly moving away, they're like, I don't want to get emotionally close to someone again because that was painful the first time. Is that we have to spend time like being with our inner child so that our inner child knows that our bodies, that our identities as me, as Brendan, is a safe place to be. And then from that place, I can move forward with an inner sense of safety. And once I have that, then I can move in the world with way more confidence that it's like, I don't have to be second guessing whether this woman's going to judge me. Like, if I open the door for her, will she think I'm not a feminist, that she couldn't open the door? And then you don't get like cognitively overthinking. It's like, you know what? I will open this door because I want to open this door. Not because I think this is what I need to do, or not because I think that she can't open the door for herself. Like, it's just like, maybe, and if she doesn't get upset with me, be like, I can open my own door. Be like, okay, great. I just wanted to do this. But you can kind of just hold your own and be in your own and not be so, like, it's like those teenage boys that are just trying to fit in for the sake of not losing relationship with other people. Yeah. Like, it's a hard ask, but the necessary ask for how can we like hold our own in a gentle, respectful way, but like not in a laying over way either. And that becomes, we have to get that relationship with ourselves first.
So profound. Like, you said so many points in there. I was just like, yes, that's 1,000% true. You talked about your inner child. This is the first time since doing my own inner work with my child and someone that did body work. And it was like so profound, really getting to where I am and how I cope and please and the things that I do. And I love that you also said, you know, you don't want to be that man that just says yes, right? Because that guy becomes resentful. He becomes, like you said, entitled. But he also is like, well, at some point, he's not his true authentic self and he's going to explode in some way, whether it's like on you or at you or become, you know, all of these things. And so it is so profound. It's so important to become at peace with who you are and whatever work that looks like for you. Then do it. You know, there's no right or wrong, like you said. Just because something worked for you doesn't mean that that's going to work for me. And I love that there's different motives and there's different people to do that. And yeah, that's huge. And I think the more you know yourself, the more confident you are, then you can be yourself. And like, you don't like me? Okay, I can't change your opinion on that, but I'm fine with that.
Totally. And if I can use the Lord of the Rings analogy, just because I love Lord of the Rings, huge fan, if any of your audience loves Lord of the Rings, is that how I liken it is like, if you look at generally an all male cast for the most part, And you look at them and be like, who is the most authentic, or who has like the best masculinity? Who's the kind of your idols or ideal? I feel like Aragorn is going to be up there on most people's list because like he empowers people around him. He's someone that like most men would want to follow into battle. But then if you look at the other ones, it's like one, Sam, the gardener, is actually who Tolkien believed was the true hero of the whole story. And it's like, is Sam's masculinity, which like it's often made fun of that he's like gay with Frodo, things like that. But his love for Frodo, like is his masculinity less than Aragorn's masculinity just because it's maybe just not as like so large? Or like, it's like, no, Sam is exactly the type of hobbit. He's exactly the type of male that he needs to be. And I think we can get locked up in like, oh, I want to be like this man. Versus like, I want to be like, Sam needs to be the most Sam, Pippin needs to be the most Pippin, Legolas the most Legolas. They don't need to try to be each other. Like we need to, that's why the inner child looking inward, we need to be the most Brendan that we can be. And I don't want anyone else to try to be Brendan as well. And so, yeah, is there confusing messages around masculinity? I think, yeah, but there's like double standards. You can get so lost in looking at all the double standards, regardless of what gender you are. There are so many double standards out there. And I think a lot of men are in this limbo state of not knowing what is best. Or like, for instance, let's say like a lot of men use working out as like their therapy, or they go through a divorce or break up and then it's like, right, hit the gym. This is what I'm doing. One, I think you can work out and it's a source of embodiment, getting connected. And I think that's so great. But you can also be working out to like disconnect you. And I think you have to kind of just be honest with that and be like just constantly evolving in an evolution of like, I have so many different threads of what this working out is. That working out, I think, has so many physical positive benefits. And it's also interesting that there's a meme online of being like, a guy will literally do anything rather than go to therapy. So I think that if you just focused on like, what are the messages out there, be like, oh, they're judging me for working out now. It's like, no, working out has been like a life-saving thing for me. It's like, sometimes we need to set aside everything on the internet versus like what actually, check in with yourself. Is working out for you because you love yourself, or are you working out because you hate yourself? And then work with that. I think sometimes we give too much power to all these ideas that are out there and not checking in with ourselves of what actually feels congruent. And of course, this gets difficult because the more we've been disconnected from ourselves, the harder it is to know, are we doing this because it's authentic, or are we doing this because we've just been taught that? And I don't think we have to arrive at like this clear answer. Like, I played volleyball at a fairly high level. I still to this day don't know if I played volleyball because I loved it, or because my dad played it and I wanted to make my dad proud. But like, kind of those evolve and they kind of intertwine together. So
those are some really good points.
Sorry, I'm talking for a long time. Back to you.
No. I love that. I love seeing the passion behind what you do, because I want the experts on here. I want the people that are passionate. I want the people that have to share. They're not only like your research, but your opinions too, because, you know, that's what the show is about. Yeah. And I think that that's so profound too. And you said there is like, there's such this polarization between both sexes. And I find that, like, I know this is a little controversial, so I won't go down this whole road, but, you know, the Me Too movement, right? I feel that since that happened, I think it was necessary in a lot of ways, but it's also almost masks men's feelings even more, where it's like, oh, I really can't say anything. Like, I can't voice my opinion or my thoughts or my beliefs because, you know, I'm just going to get like emasculated or whatever, you know. It's going to be like, I can't voice myself. So I feel like there's pros and cons to every movement, you know. And I think as feminism has evolved too, of course, we physically can do stuff like the men can do. We can open our own door. We can do this. But to allow like the dance, the masculine and the feminine, right? We've got to embrace one of those energies for to work, because two masculinities is competition and two feminine, you know, energies, just nothing gets done. So I feel like there is that need in that dance, but getting clear with who you are and being authentic, like that inner child thing was perfect. Like it's something everybody needs to understand or at least start doing research a little bit more about that.
What I wish anytime something like a Me Too movement happens, it's like, I think what I wish could happen when anyone expresses, hey, this is a lived reality for so many women, is that men, other people could just like hold the space for their distress and their discomfort instead of being like, well, here's what it points, or like, this makes it more complicated. It's like, that's not what the point initially was. Like, and it's just like, can we, and I think this will just save so much in relationships, and anytime there's distress in an intimate partner relationship, it's like raising kids. It's like, can you hold and tolerate your child's emotional distress without making it about you or taking it on? Because all the women that I've researched or talked to, it's not that they don't want men to, yeah, some women don't want men to approach them ever to like, if you were attracted or wanted to maybe take someone on a date. But a lot of women are like, no, we just want you to do it in a way that you're aware of your body and your presence and what might feel like a safe way to approach or not. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think our ability as a culture to like, I think why the controversy exists so much between feminism, anti-feminism, things like that is like, if, and this is obviously as generalization, if women felt seen and heard in what they're trying to say, then I think it's easier to also see and hear men and what they're doing. And so like, it's like, I hate when they get like these suffering competitions of like, oh, here's my pain. Oh, well, here's my pain. And it's like the whataboutisms and things like that. It's like, I really care about women's pain, and that totally impacts and influences the work I do. I totally hold what boys and men's pain and what they go through, and I view those as significant in and of themselves, period. And I also see those as like deeply intertwined. Like when I went to leave my job and go do my PhD, I told my high school students that I was researching, and I had some grade 9 girls come up to me, and she's like, or they're like, Mr. K, like, why are you just researching boys? Don't you care about girls? And it's like, oh, I see these things as so interconnected and interrelated. And I care about LGBTQ community as well. So yeah, I don't view healing as a scarcity mindset. It's like, we all need to heal. And your healing, ultimately, I feel like is connected to mine and helps me to heal. And sometimes that's comforting, because someone else's healing can be really empowering for them, and it might bring up shame for me. But instead of like antagonizing, aiming that shame, like, or getting anger to avoid feeling that shame, be like, is there something that it might be teaching me? And maybe there's a place to grow.
Wow. That's really, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I've had multiple conversations with just really good friends who, in discussion of maybe my own feelings or my own journey, it has been like a repellent on some of those things to this person, almost like it brought up something for themselves, but it was almost like an attack, which it, like, it was just expressing like what I was going through and doing. And so it's really interesting that you say that, because I think that there's a lot of learning there, right? Oh, why am I reacting this way when my friend's just trying to open up and have conversation, and I'm becoming like that doesn't work for me. So how do we, and you said this with children, right? I have a 16-year-old, so I've been through the many years of rearing, and I've noticed when my own emotion comes out when she's talking about something, and it has ruined the conversation. And I didn't realize I was doing it until she actually brought it up to me. Like, no, this is not about you. So how do we heal some of that? How do we recognize that, like, oh, our own issues are popping up? Maybe I need to step back and like figure this out because it's harming this relationship.
Yeah. So there's a term in psychology, I use this language of like, when I get blended with a part of myself. So if I get activated or blended, I call it, it's like when I get kind of tunnel vision on like a situation. So like if my daughter is having a hissy fit in a store, because I've done therapy, but because I've like also spent time identifying what's going on, like I know that when I get emotionally dysregulated, so I know what the signs are in my body of what emotional dysregulation is like. And like, I care more about not making a fuss in public. It's like, oh, I know that I was a child who was like the golden child growing up in my family. I didn't want to ever cause my parents distress because I learned to manage their emotions rather than like sitting with my own. And so it's like, oh, when my daughter causes something, or like I feel judgment, like I don't want people in public to judge me, like that's all about me. It's like doing a U-turn about like, how is what my child or my partner saying, like, what's that saying about my relationship with myself? So like, why can we get so hurt in our intimate partner relationships when like a woman in a heterosexual relationship, let's say, or like a woman says like, oh, you're not doing this. And so I think most men struggle with not being enough. And so it's like, oh, it's pressing that pressure point of like, oh, but like you missed what I was trying to do, or all these things. And it's like, we can make that so much about the other person rather than like, if we can just separate for a moment and like breathe some space into like, okay, I'm having a reaction that like, oh, I struggle with not feeling like I'm enough. And so when my partner says this, it hits that old wound. But can I separate my years of experiences as a child not feeling enough from like this one moment of not feeling enough? And like this gets into repair work. Like the part of the reason why I do cold plunges too is that I find that it helps me unblend and get back to my body. And then from there, I can kind of work at it. And so like you need to kind of identify some like resources in your life that you can get. And one of the things working with teenage boys, we talk about being hyper aroused versus being hypo aroused. Hyper aroused is being like activated in like kind of fight aggressive energy. And then hypo aroused is being kind of really lethargic, kind of numbing behavior. And in the middle, it's called your window of tolerance. And that's kind of your optimal zone for staying. But a lot of these boys identified like, oh, I don't spend any time in the window of tolerance, which is optimal. It's like either I'm kind of numbing out. I'm not meaning to shame video games, but like I'm just playing video games and I'm not actually working through my emotions. But like when I'm overwhelmed playing video games, and then something happens and then immediately activated and the hyper aroused again. And so, yeah, there's all these like psychological concepts and tools to identify it. But we talked earlier on the show or earlier before about emotional intelligence. It's like one of the things, emotional intelligence has like, depending on the list, 3 to 6 different attributes. One is being able to identify your emotions. One is being able to understand your emotions, and one is being able to regulate your emotions. And then the other one is able to navigate your emotions within relationships. All this kind of, you kind of have to start by identifying your emotions. And that might just be like a physical feeling in your body of like where your emotions are, because emotions are attached to our bodies. Not like emotions are just in our head. No, our bodies actually really show emotions. So men who are more likely to really be stoic, or I actually don't like that word, but to really shut down their emotions, is they might think that they don't have emotions, but the research shows that men have actually higher body reactivity to emotional stimuli, even though they report and on their face it looks like they're not showing emotions. Like for instance, in a couple studies, like they've shown different movie clips, each designed to elicit a certain emotional response. So horror, scaredness, sadness, happiness, blah, blah, blah. For most of them, men reported experiencing lower emotional reactions to it verbally, but they set them up with heart rate monitors, check their skin conductivity, because you can tell your levels of anxiety based on how conductive your skin is. And men were consistently in almost all the emotions higher from a physiological response. So with getting connected to our bodies, like I think embodiment, talking about authenticity, I think embodiment, getting connected with our bodies and ourselves is such a huge piece of this puzzle.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you said like the first part of emotional intelligence is recognizing what that emotion is, right? Because I think a lot of us maybe have, or let's not say us because I'm a female, but let's stick with the boys and the men here where they've been told numerous times to shut it down, you know, don't cry, you know, be a man, da, 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 all these things. And so maybe they don't even know what that is for them, that emotion. You know, well, I'm mad or I'm frustrated, or I'm hurt or, you know, whatever that is. And then looking a little bit deeper, how to deal with that too. So yeah, that's just, I know it sounds so infantile, but I think so many people have been, especially these men have been raised from such a young age to stuff that down.
Yeah. And they just have on average, like less emotional practice with doing this. And it's, but counter to the point I just said is that there was an interesting argument that could be made from my research is that the boys that were highly emotionally restricted, so not willing to share their emotions, there's a good argument to be made that they were actually really emotionally aware because they were really aware of what their emotional states were so that they could hide it from people, being like, oh, I'm not going to do this because I might risk showing emotion. And for instance, the boy that was the most emotionally restricted, like, tell me if this actually sounds like he's unaware, out of touch, because I don't think he is. He's like, when my parents got divorced, I realized that I need to help my mom and my younger sisters hold it together. So like, I know that I clammed up my emotions then and I willingly did this. And he's like, maybe in like 10, 15 years, I'm going to like have an outburst of anger at something really small that I know wasn't actually about the thing, but it's because I've restricted my emotions. And he longed for like, he's like, I wish I wasn't this self-aware. He's like, it'd be nice. Wouldn't it just be nice to be ignorant? It's like, totally, man. Sometimes like therapy, like why the heck do therapy? Like, wasn't it kind of blissfully unaware of how life
was? Oh, to be that young again, right?
Yeah. So I also don't want to see in the narrative that boys are, on general, just less emotionally intelligent. I think there's an area of other emotional intelligence that maybe is weaker or less practiced, but I think that even the highly emotionally restricted are still very like aware of their emotions, but there is sometimes the learning curve is like, how do I, what do you actually do with them? Or like, cause kind of right now the default mode is like ignore them or suppress them.
Yeah. That doesn't do anybody good, especially the person that's doing that. So, well, I mean, there's so much research. There's so many, like, I could talk to you for days. I love all of this stuff. I really do hope that this resonated with you all here and you were able to take some pieces because I definitely do. This is like my PhD, the podcast. I'm like, okay, because I get to learn from everybody and especially you. Like, I really appreciate that. And I know people here are as well are constantly learning, right? I think anybody that jumps on a podcast and wants to know about relationships and dating and sex and all, like, ooh, let's talk, you know, let's find more about like how I can be better, how I can show up better in relationships. So thank you again for being on today's show. I do have one last question for you that is I ask all my guests. So it's just a little bit personal, but what was one of your favorite dates and what was it?
My favorite dates?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I joke about this being my favorite date, but I'm so disappointed because it was my first date with my wife, which I recreated, but I just feel like the bar went. My very first date I ever did was my favorite and the best. Yeah, I don't love that. But we went canoeing. It's called Widgeon Creek near Vancouver, and it's beautiful. Canoeing to a waterfall and have packed a lunch. And just, yeah, being outside in nature, but you have a time to talk, but you're doing an activity. And then we saw some very classic Canadian beavers swimming and doing all these things. Yeah, it was just like a day adventure like that. That was probably my, yeah, we've done more day adventures to probably defend myself there. But my best.
It's so great. I thank you for sharing that. Believe it or not, a lot of people's first date are their favorites. So don't feel left out. And also, because you had a sense of adventure, connection, you had all the good feels, right? There was a lot of things going on to create this. I mean, that's just from what I've experienced and what I tell my clients. And that was like, no, don't beat yourself up. That was like perfect. And I think people here really love hearing what those dates are, because they're like, well, either different ideas or like, what was it about it that made it so great for you? So, yeah. So yeah, anyways.
If I could just do the U-turn back, demonstrate the U-turn. Like, oh yeah, I prefaced all that because I felt like a sense of shame that like, oh, I don't want it to seem like I gave up pursuing my wife after the first date type thing. And that's just been downhill from there. Like, no, that actually hasn't been the case. For sure. In our 10-year marriage, there's been time periods where I've neglected dates more than other times, but that was going on for me. It's like, oh, I don't want to just seem like I don't care about my wife.
Oh my gosh, that's wonderful. I love that date. So you guys, I'm sure, love it as well. Yeah. No shame in it. Well, and also, where can people find more information about you, follow you on social media?
Yeah. So remasculine.com. I'm kind of like a play on words of like regarding masculinity, but yeah, remasculine.com has links. I would say TikTok and Instagram I'm most prominent on. I have lots of plans for 2024. Yeah, some webinars, a book in the works. So nothing to write home about yet. In 2024, hopefully there'll be a lot more different types of media as well.
I love that. Well, go find him on TikTok and Instagram, and then I'm sure you're going to post on there when you launch all of your webinars and launch your book. So it'll be good for everybody to know where to find you. So again, thank you so much for being on the show. And it was so great to learn from you.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
If you enjoyed today's episode and want to support podcasts like ours, then please hit that subscribe button, leave a 5-star rating, and or invite others to listen. Your support is what helps us grow and continue to bring you valuable content. Thanks for hanging out with us on today's episode. Let's stay connected. You can find me on Instagram at Celeste More Image, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on today's discussion. For all the links, resources, and additional information mentioned in this episode, check out the show notes on my website, celestemore.com. That's all for now, but stay tuned for our next episode where we'll dive into more exciting topics. Until then, see you next time, friends.